From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. Now, if you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio. And my friends, listen carefully to today's show. We'll be talking about issues that I never thought we'd be talking about. Our nation is changing dramatically. Basic rights are weakening. Discrimination and hate are being celebrated in the front yard of the White House. Coalitions once never imagined are now gaining a level of strength that we must deal with decisively. As I share the program with you today, I realize that I'm not just passing along news. I am outlining an agenda for all who want to preserve our democracy.
If 70% of Americans are still Christians, silence is not an option. Today's complacency is tomorrow's captivity.
For years, American Christians, basically white evangelical Christians, have been told that they are oppressed, disrespected, and that their religious freedom is in danger. The messaging came from self-interested parties on the political religious right. But recently, those manufactured grievances have been amplified by court rulings and political leaders at the highest levels. Inevitably, that's having an impact. As confirmed by the latest survey from the Public Religion Research Institute, on this week's show, we'll get details from PRRI President Dr. Robert P. Jones.
The yearly National Prayer Breakfast.
There are about 60 representatives from the Russian delegation, from religious and political elite, which is about three times the number as last year.
There's been ample coverage of the many contacts between figures in our current administration and the government of the one nation on earth intent on changing the global balance of power, Russia. In a post-truth age, many feel it is their free choice to believe or disbelieve this reporting. But detailed stories on links between the American religious right and Russia are something else again. A series in the respected nonpartisan religion news service lays out some of these links, and I'll talk with journalist Jack Jenkins later in the hour. But first,
you will not replace us!
You will not replace us! You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
Last week, I spoke with Rabbi Jack Moline about the reimagining interfaith rally he took part in at Lafayette Park. It's just across from the White House in Washington, D.C., and the traditional site of countless public protests and assemblies. This week, as America marks the dark first anniversary of the bloody Unite the Right march in Charlottesville, Virginia, Lafayette Park will be the site of a celebration of white supremacy as the organizers reunite for a public hate fest in the heart of our nation's capital. Well, I find it hard to believe there will be good people on both sides. I'm heartened at the amount of creative and peaceful counter-protesting that has been planned, much of it by religious-oriented organizations. One such initiative is the United to Love rally And I am pleased to be joined now by the Reverend Stacy Cole Wilson, Executive Minister of Justice and Service at the Baltimore-Washington Conference of the United Methodist Church. Stacy, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. Thank you so much.
What's the event you've got planned for Sunday in Washington?
So on the mall, beginning at 7 a.m. through 3 p.m., we will have an inclusive gathering of persons across lines of difference, persons who exemplify simple human opposition and rejection of racism, hierarchy of human value, the concept of white supremacy, and the violent advocacy and implications of same and those who promote them. From 7 a.m., we will have prayer. From 11 a.m. to 12:30, there will be an interfaith worship service. From 12:30 to around 1, there will be just music. And then from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., we will have speakers that span from the United Methodist Church, the Episcopal Church, Lutheran Church, Sojourners, NAN, possibly the Rainbow Push, the Poor People's Campaign, just a wide variety of speakers who share the notion and concept that it is not in any form okay to perpetuate hate, to be hateful in speech or action for those who resist and reject hateful policies and practices. All of those persons are welcome to lift their voice in love on that day.
So how can our listeners in the D.C. area take part in United to Love?
Persons can join us online, UnitedToLove.org. They can join us there, and there you'll get all the information about the rally, the pre-rally events, post-rally events, the lineup of the day. You'll get information how to travel to the mall where we'll be. We'll be across from the reflecting pool at the Capitol, which is on 3rd Street in front of the Native American Museum, not far away from the Air and Space Museum, across the street from the National Gallery of Art. We will gather there in mass. We have approximately 630 congregations in the United Methodist Church, and we've asked for at least 400 persons per district to be present, which should be about 3,200. And we've also asked for our jurisdictional partners to come, in addition to our interfaith and ecumenical partners, because truly, this is not an event that is to be named by the United Methodist Church. This is something to be named and owned by any person who resists hate. It's a collective. It is an inclusive, diverse body of persons who can see that silence is not an option in the face of this kind of behavior. It is not okay. And so we want persons to come to speak the truth in love while remaining contextually and culturally appropriate, on topic and respectful. We want to focus on how we can justly and ethically use our voices and votes to change, dismantle, reject unjust policies and practices. We're asking persons to avoid divisive and demeaning language, to refrain from language that demeans and or could be considered vitriolic. But most of all, we're asking persons to come to unconditionally love God and neighbor, and to consider what that looks like, what it means to be a connected family that will do no harm and utilize our sacred text in context. And then to move from that moment, to move from that day, to inspire others to do the same, to move from that day or to move from Sunday with a covenant, with a commitment to be a peacemaker, to be an agent of justice, to actually place our faith in action on behalf of the most vulnerable among us.
Why was an alternative rally an attractive way to respond to this white supremacist gathering?
It is essential for persons of faith to model concepts and principles that we share from pulpits and in personal places. And one of those essential core concepts is love, love of God, love of neighbor, love of self. And so it is not loving to be silent in the face of human opposition. It is not loving to accept racism. It is not loving to accept any hierarchy of human value or the concept of white supremacy or any kind of privilege. It is not loving to be violent. It is in our best interest as a church to utilize our voice and to utilize our faith, to put our faith into action and say, we've gathered on this day not only to say that we as a church, we as a body, we as a group of persons across lines of difference believe that love is the most powerful force in the world and that love is revolutionary, as we've heard earlier in the year from Bishop Curry and others, and of course through our scriptures, but that love is what will lead us into the next phase of existence. Love is how we will overcome every form of evil. And love is the highest expression of who we're called to be as human beings.
I think the United to Love rally is a prophetic response to the Lafayette Park event on Sunday. But I'd like to know what your initial reaction was when you heard this supremacist gathering on the first anniversary of Charlottesville was coming to our nation's capital.
It wasn't the first time. I mean, we know that this isn't the first gathering like this of its kind. I believe that there was a white supremacist rally last year in D.C. So for me, it was disheartening. It was something that I know to my core that is against D.C. values, but it is in keeping with our First Amendment rights. And so I value First Amendment rights. I value persons being able to express their beliefs and to have freedom of speech. And so in that regard, I respect the ability for persons to share. Also, it is disheartening to think in 2018 that we have persons who still believe in any hierarchy of human value, or persons who believe that in order for us to move forward as a nation, that we can move forward with hatred in our hearts for one another. And so, in the words of Dr. King and others, the church is called to be the moral conscience of the nation. That was my call. Like, God, how are we, as the Baltimore-Washington Conference, how are we as people of faith, how are we under the leadership of Bishop Latrell Easterling, who called us into this vision, how are we going to respond for such a time as this with a prophetic voice, with a voice that is from you, that is not about our own agenda, that is not about our will, but about your will being done on earth? How do we call persons across lines of difference to gather in one space on one particular day, on a day that is for many a Sabbath day, a day that is considered in some regard the most segregated hour in the nation? How can we get persons together to say that worship is beyond a building, that it is truly beyond a sanctuary, a synagogue, that worship is a state of being and that it can happen anywhere, and those who are worshipers do worship in spirit and in truth? Like, how can we leave physical structures to be love at work in the world? And that was my prayer in calling folks together. And after having many conversations with many persons who heard about our efforts to organize for this day, to help them to really get an understanding that this is not in place of worship. This is not simply a counter rally. This is a call to the nation to be love, to live with the highest principle of love, and to reject anything or any ethos that will call us to be less than loving creatures created by God.
Stacy, in the long term, what's the role for religious denominations in substantively impacting the unexpected debate we're having around race and privilege in this country?
MLK's observation that the church is called to be the conscience of the nation still stands today, and Francis Asbury and company claimed as our calling to spread scriptural holiness across the continent. So it is the church's role to lead through our faith in speaking out against injustice anywhere in any place it resides. It is the church's role, it is the faith-based leader's role, prophetic role, to speak the truth to power and to resist every system of oppression and to work to do whatever is needed and legal and possible to dismantle those systems. It is also the church's role to understand that God expects us to be righteous and to be streams of justice, and to let those streams of justice flow from our mouths and our hands of peace, to be people of faith who are peacemakers. That is what God expects of us. And it doesn't look the same in every place. It doesn't mean that every person will march, every person will show up to a counter event, but it does mean that each person is responsible for living this gospel in love and for being love and light in the world. Each person is responsible for examining him or herself to say, God, what does it look like to be just in the world. What does love look like? What does loving my neighbor look like, even if my neighbor does not look or think like me? So I think it is essential for the church to be a part of the race conversation. I think it is not something that we can avoid. I think we must confront it and name it if we choose to address it and be relieved of it.
The Reverend Stacy Cole Wilson is the Executive Minister of Justice and Service at the Baltimore-Washington Conference of the United Methodist Church. Sunday at 11 o'clock a.m., people of goodwill are gathering on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., under the banner of United to Love, even as the white supremacist Unite the Right rally takes over Lafayette Park in the heart of Washington, D.C. There's more information available at unitedtolove.org. UnitedToLove.org. Stacy, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio. We hope with you that all goes well on Sunday.
Blessings, and thank you, Welton. Thank you for this time and for this opportunity to share.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from a religion news reporter who's found himself unexpectedly drawn into covering the connection between Russia and the American religious right, Jack Jenkins. And up next, Public Religion Research Institute President Dr. Robert P. Jones. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. It's not uncommon for the comprehensive findings of the Public Religion Research Institute to make headlines and to highlight trends that define who we are as a nation and who we're becoming. That's true once again as the Justice Department turns the focus on religious liberty. While many of us define that term as meaning members of minority religions around the world should be free to exercise their beliefs, the political religious right in the U.S. thinks it should primarily concern the right to exercise their beliefs no matter who gets hurt. Big difference. For a look at the trends around religious liberty, as it's understood and misunderstood in this country, I'm happy to welcome Public Religion Research Institute President Dr. Robert P. Jones back to State of Belief Radio. Robbie, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
What caught my eye right away was the shift you identify in American views regarding religious freedom in this country. So let's start there.
Yeah. Well, it is about religious liberty, but it's in a very, very specific context. So we asked, in the wake of the Master Pete Cake case at the Supreme Court in June, which, as you know, was a case where a evangelical baker didn't want to bake a cake for the gay couple, and the Supreme Court ruling didn't really rule on the merits of the case, but they at least did rule that the way that Colorado handled the case was not correct. And so the merits of the case are still kind of out. But we decided to ask people in the context of that kind of where they were on this issue of whether businesses, and particularly wedding-related businesses, should be required to serve all comers, or whether they should be allowed to refuse services to same-sex couples if they have a religious objection. And we basically found that the country is divided on this question. But that does represent a 5-point increase in the number of Americans who said bakers and other wedding service providers should be allowed to refuse service to gay and lesbian couples.
Robbie, would you say it's not a decline in support for religious freedom, or is it just about this particular issue?
You know, it's interesting. It is definitely about this specific issue. We also have a more generic question where we ask, not in the context of wedding-related services, but just in generally, whether small business owners should be allowed to refuse services as well. We also saw some drop in opposition there. We had a fairly strong majority opposition. We're also showing Americans divided on that question. However, the one group that has not moved on this issue, and I think it's a good window into where the debate is, are actually African Americans. They're divided when you ask about weddings, but when you ask about whether just businesses in general should be able to refuse service on religious grounds to gay and lesbian people, they are 2-1 basically saying, no, this is not a blank check for all small businesses, even if they're a little divided on the wedding-specific question.
If I were to speculate that the incessant messaging from the political religious right and some of our highest government officials is contributing to this shift, are there other areas of the survey or what you know that might reinforce that theory, or is that asking too much of the data?
Well, no, it's a good point. And, you know, this Supreme Court case in June received a lot of publicity. There was a lot of buildup to it. It became, you know, a talking point among many on the kind of conservative end of politics. So we heard a lot about it. And I think for many Americans, it was the first time they had really thought about this issue very carefully. It's not one that tends to be on the radar of kind of average everyday Americans. And I think that did have an impact on it. But, you know, what we see is that that impact is fairly limited to this kind of the wedding issue here. There's some other evidence in the poll that it's certainly not the case that people have broadly changed their minds on the question of LGBT rights. That's not at all what we see in the poll. So, for example, in the same poll, we see nearly two-thirds of the country now saying that they favor allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry. That's as high as we've really ever seen it in a survey, and that number continues to tick up pretty much every time we're in the field. On this survey, just for example, we had a majority of seniors age 65 and older saying they now support same-sex marriage. We've never seen that before on a public opinion poll. So that is, I think, a better measure of kind of where, you know, the winds are still blowing in that direction on questions of basic non-discrimination policies in the workplace or in public accommodations. Overwhelming majorities of Americans continue to support those issues. So I think it really is in this kind of smaller area of wedding-related services and this issue of kind of using the principle of religious liberty to find kind of carve-outs for conservative Christians to refuse services when they're running businesses. That's where I think there has been a little more divide in the country in the wake of the Supreme Court case. You know, what'll be interesting is to see, we often see these kinds of things happening around big legislative events or Supreme Court cases, and there's a kind of temporal effect that tends to go away. So before the Supreme Court case, we had majority opposition to these kinds of religiously based service refusals. It'll be interesting to see when we get a few more weeks out whether this is a blip and, you know, that's just a response to the publicity around the court case, or whether it is more of a more permanent move of the needle. My hunch is that it's more of a blip in response to the court case than it is some permanent shift in American attitudes.
Well, another issue of concern in this your findings has to do with the Muslim and Jewish Americans. There were stark findings about these two groups. Will you talk about that, please?
Yeah, you know, so we also ask, in addition to these questions, a broader set of questions that were about who's facing discrimination in the country. And we've asked these questions over time. So the nice thing about this is that we can actually see where people are, you know, as we kind of look at a five-year trend on this question. Mm-hmm. And what we basically see is that there's this partisan shift in perceptions of who's facing discrimination in the country. And it's quite remarkable, actually, that among Democrats, we asked about gay and lesbian people, transgender people, Muslims, women, and Jews. More Democrats today say that these groups face a lot of discrimination than they did 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Among Republicans, though, we see this dramatic slide in the number of Republicans who say any of these groups face a lot of discrimination today. In most of the cases, it's a shift of 20 percentage points or more. So, for example, on Muslims, 5 years ago, 60% of Republicans, or 6 in 10 Republicans, said that Muslims face a lot of discrimination in the country today. And in our latest measure, only 38% say that today. And so that's really a remarkable shift, you know, along partisan lines on a question that's as basic as whether a group faces discrimination or not. You know, it's not just kind of policy issues, but even basic descriptive facts in the country that are increasingly seen through partisan lenses. And the rhetoric we've heard from many Republican leaders is that it's not these kind of religious or ethnic minority groups that are facing discrimination, but instead it's either whites or Christians. We've had other polls where we've asked about that, and what we see among Republicans is this uptick in the sense that, you know, if anyone's persecuted, it's Christians or white Americans. And in fact, among Republicans, the last time we asked it that way, Republicans were more likely to say that Christians face discrimination than African Americans did, for example.
Well, as you've mentioned, the survey was largely focused on LGBTQ issues. So talk a little bit more about the specific findings there.
I do think the big picture here is that the support for LGBT rights in general continues to move in an upward trajectory. This poll is, you know, still finding that. We also asked about President Trump specifically. That might be that it's notable that we asked about whether President Trump's policies were helping or hurting gay and lesbian people. And, you know, despite the fact that Trump came out in the campaign and was the first Republican to kind of talk in a positive way about gay rights, he had Peter Thiel, who's openly gay, come speak at the Republican National Convention, sent some signals earlier on that he might take a different tack than previous Republican administrations are. But since then, there's been a number of things that his administration has done to roll back rights for LGBT people, and we see this in the reflection of public opinion. Today, Americans are about four times as likely to say that the Trump administration's policies are hurting gay and lesbian people rather than helping them. So 34% say they're hurting, only 9% say that they're helping gay and lesbian people.
Mm-hmm. Robbie, your book, The End of White Christian America, which I think is important to mention, it's now available in paperback. It focuses on the demographic changes that we're seeing and sets up some expectations for how that will impact our nation in the years ahead. Big picture, do you think what we're seeing is just a last gasp backlash to these changes before the inevitable happens?
Well, you know, I think yes. I mean, in short, yes. The percentage of white Christians in the country has continued to decrease. 10 years ago, in 2008, the country was 54% white and Christian. Our latest numbers show that number down to 42%, and that's if you take all white non-Hispanic Christians together, whether they be Catholic, Orthodox, Protestant, whatever, non-denominational. That's it's still only 42% of the country. And if we look particularly at white evangelical Protestants, during that same period, they've gone from 23% of the country, nearly a quarter of the country. Our latest numbers show them down to 15%. Now, you wouldn't know that from their public influence in the current administration, and you wouldn't know that at the ballot box because they actually are overrepresented in fairly large numbers at the ballot box because they turn out and vote. But there is a kind of sleight of hand going on, I think, sometimes when you hear people in the administration like Jeff Sessions, when he announced recently this Religious Liberty Task Force, he often talks about people of faith and their concerns. And, you know, it's increasingly clear that when he says people of faith, what he really means is white evangelical Protestants. And he's really only talking about 15% of the country that fit that definition of people of faith. So it leaves out the vast majority of religious people when he cites having these particular concerns, and certainly the growing number of non-religious people in the country as well.
What concerns me is how this administration is methodically, if chaotically, reducing access to this country for travelers and immigrants, as well as pushing some mostly non-white people out. Are the numbers involved here enough to impact the long-term demographic trends you describe in your book, or is it just a delay that won't make much difference in the long term?
I think it is a delay. Most of the demographic change that we're seeing in the country is basically baked in. What I mean by that is that it's now dependent mostly on differential birth rates, the aging of white evangelical Protestants, in particular the exodus of young white people from Christian churches into the unaffiliated category. All those dynamics, I think, are the bigger influx. Now, where there are levers to pull are more at who gets to vote. So I think we'll see a lot more fights over voting rights, voter restrictions, voter suppression, and immigration policy. Even things like, do people who've been convicted of a felony, are they able to vote? The public overwhelmingly supports restoring rights to felons who have served their time, but the states have a patchwork of things here, and it disproportionately affects African-American men in particular, that policy does. So there'll be a lot of things like that around the edges. I think for the most part what it does is it delays the inevitable at the ballot box. It doesn't sort of put it off, but it does delay it. But that can be significant. I mean, we're already at a point where if you look at the composition of people who vote, they look like the country did at least 10 years ago. So we're already essentially 10 years behind in the composition of the voting population compared to the actual population of the country. So if you are able to kind of tinker around the edges, you might be able to continue that gap and maybe even expand that gap so that the voting population looks like the country did 15 years ago, and it acts like a kind of time machine for public policy and public representation.
The New Public Religion Research Institute surveys reveals a growing support for religiously justified discrimination and much, much more. You can read all of it at PRRI.org. Robbie, as always, we've covered a whole lot of ground here, and I'm so grateful for your expertise. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio again, and thank you again for all that you're doing.
Well, thanks, Welton, for the kind words, and I'm always happy to be here.
When Franklin Graham met Putin. Now, that's the headline of the latest installment in the Religion News Service series tracking connections between Russia and the American religious right. And I'm joined right now by the author, RNS national reporter, Jack Jenkins. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
What in the world got you started looking at the connection between Russia and the American religious right?
That's an interesting question. So I actually started working on these connections more than a year and a half ago. I kind of did a gloss of the fact that the religious right in Russia had some connections, because we were vaguely aware that, Russians had, according to the intelligence community, had tried to infiltrate or influence the 2016 election. And we knew that some of the ways they had done that were through religion. So I started looking into the different kinds of relationships that had already existed. Now, at the time, one of the things I kind of stumbled upon was the National Prayer Breakfast, which is, an event that's held every year in Washington, D.C., and it's a premier meeting among politicians and even world leaders. And I started kind of tracking those connections, and just a few weeks ago, after I'd done months of work on that, it broke that the Department of Justice had arrested a woman by the name of Maria Butina, who had apparently, allegedly, tried to exploit the National Prayer Breakfast to create a back channel between Russian officials or Russian actors and American officials or actors. And so there was this new deluge of coverage around these sorts of connections, because the National Prayer Breakfast was started with help from Billy Graham, decades and decades and decades ago. There often are religious right actors who are there. So the truth is, though, that that's only the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot of other kinds of connections that don't necessarily mean that these religious right leaders were actively trying to help the Russians influence our elections, but it helps explain why the religious right might have been targeted by Russians to do so.
I'm interested in what you found regarding Putin and Graham.
That relationship is fascinating, and I actually have to back up a little bit to answer it. One thing that's important to know, and this is pretty well tested, is that around 2010, 2011, 2012, really at the beginning of Putin's third term, there became this growing alliance between the Russian government and the Russian Orthodox Church. Now, it would be an overstatement to say the church is an arm of the government, but there seems to be this really tightly knit marriage of convenience between these two different groups, the government and the Orthodox Church, to the point where the New York Times has written articles about how Russian Orthodox Church officials have been used, or at least worked in concert with the Russian government, to kind of exert Russian influence across Europe. Now, the reason I bring that up is because back in 2011 and 2013, there's a person named Metropolitan Hilarion, who is an official of the Russian Orthodox Church, who began visiting the United States. He spoke at the Catholic University of America, a conservative Catholic school. He spoke at an evangelical seminary. He apparently visited with George W. Bush, and that was just in 2011. When he came back in 2014, it followed a publication, an opinion article published by Franklin Graham, in which Franklin Graham, in the Decision magazine, which is a publication of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, which obviously is an organization affiliated with Franklin Graham's father, had published this opinion article that basically listed up the fact that Putin had signed a bunch of a law prohibiting the expression of LGBT material in the Russian state, and kind of lifted it up as a good thing. So fast forward later that year, Metropolitan Hilarion showed up with Franklin Graham in the United States of America. He went and visited Billy Graham on his 96th birthday. Then they had a meeting at the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association with a bunch of Russian officials and American evangelicals that Franklin Graham helped broker, where Metropolitan Hilarion gave a speech. And then they went to Washington, D.C., where apparently this Russian delegation, which included both Orthodox officials like Hilarion, as well as evangelical Russians, met with government officials and visited the Capitol. And then, so that was all 2014. Now, fast forward a year from then, in 2015, and Franklin Graham just goes to Russia, just straight up goes to Russia. He preaches at multiple different churches while he's there. And all of this, for the record, is pretty public. Now, no one was necessarily hiding these sorts of connections. And while he's there, he meets with Hilarion, and they start to hatch this idea of a persecuted Christian summit. And then, according to Graham, there was an unexpected meeting that was suddenly brokered between Franklin Graham and Russian President Vladimir Putin, where they apparently met for 45 minutes, and Franklin Graham secured Putin's help for this supposed summit that was going to happen about persecuted Christians. Now, there's some things that happen after that, but that's the base level for how these connections kind of got forged.
Over the last 3 years, I've been doing some work with the USIC, and there has been a great interest in persecution, and the persecution of Christians in particular. And I have been in the session speaking, in fact, doing some of the resourceful speaking for them to talk about. And the voice of the Russian government and the voice of the Orthodox Church is one voice. And then there is this great push to try to convince people about the persecution of Christians, and Graham is pushing it related to the United States. There are other places where it is really persecution, but not there. Franklin Graham is the son of the legendary preacher Billy Graham, who was synonymous with American patriotism in
right.
ways that I was never comfortable with, to tell you the truth. But what would Billy Graham say about all of this?
Well, it's an interesting question for a lot of reasons. One, by the way, I should mention, the thing about Russia and religious liberty and religious freedom and about persecuted Christians is that according to the State Department and the International Religious Freedom Report that they put out, Russia has a pretty, you know, not great reputation about religious freedom in their own country if you're not Orthodox. In fact, evangelicals themselves often get the shrift by the Russian government, to the point where that conference on persecuted Christians that Stephen Graham wanted to host in Russia ended up having to be shifted to the United States of America the next year, because in reaction to Putin signing some legislation that prohibited proselytization. But to your question, you know, one thing that Franklin Graham often references is that in the 80s, Billy Graham visited Russia and spoke to a lot of different Russians there. And so he, you know, that sort of relationship, they often point to Billy Graham as helping inaugurate, right, you know, that post-Soviet Russia into this, you know, post-Soviet Union and the transformation into Russia. Like, Billy Graham helped with that process. Now, what's interesting is that one of the reasons why Russia is able to use the Orthodox Church to exert its influence across Europe and in the United States of America is that it has positioned itself, particularly beginning under Putin's third term, as being the global leader of the Christian right. So the fact that the government takes positions that many LGBTQ advocates argue, you know, hinder LGBTQ rights, you know, that's seen as this champion of conservative Christian values. And so they position their country as one that, you know, shores up what they argue are, you know, traditional Christian principles. And just this past week, Putin, you know, proclaimed that, you know, Christianity was this foundational element of what became the Russian state. So, you know, obviously Billy Graham was operating initially out of the context of, you know, when there was the Soviet era. But it would be interesting to know how Billy Graham actually felt about this. But it's important to note, as I noted earlier, Billy Graham himself met with Metropolitan Hilarion on his 96th birthday in Montreat, North Carolina. So he's actually part of how these relationships got forged, both beginning in the 80s and leading up to very close to his death. And in fact, when he passed away, when Billy Graham died earlier this year, Metropolitan Hilarion sent a condolence letter in which he referenced that meeting that he had with him in his home.
I'm surely interested in whether this is a growing intimacy or whether it's going to just stay where it is now. We had Jeff Charlotte on with us a couple of weeks ago talking about this. You have a powerful piece published, but are you seeing any real concern in the halls of power, or are the relationships going to continue behind the scenes no matter what? Because I'm honestly not seeing that much public concern about some pretty corrosive connections.
Right. If you're referring to the halls of power as in the current administration, no, I don't think they're particularly concerned about these relationships at all. I think they've been, you know, at least the president in particular, President Trump, has you know, lauded these sorts of connections as a good thing. And, you know, it would be remiss if I didn't note that Franklin Graham has been a long, stalwart supporter of President Trump and participated in his inauguration. So, you know, there is this element where the administration doesn't see these as a bad thing. Within evangelical circles, where, you know, these religious relationships are being forged, it's an interesting thing to observe, and it's, you know, something that I think would a lot of folks would do well to kind of, you know, dig into, because when Franklin Graham first started carving out these positions of saying, you know, maybe Vladimir Putin isn't perfect, but maybe he's doing something right when it comes to traditional values, quote unquote, you know, he got a lot of pushback. Some, you know, traditional evangelicals weren't, you know, more institutional evangelicals like Russell Moore, head of the Southern Baptist Convention's political arm, and others didn't side with Franklin Graham on this. But, you know, those sorts of institutional evangelicals, the ones that traditionally held a lot of public sway, you know, in the Trump era, they've kind of moved, you know, into the background, and people like Franklin Graham have been moved into the fore. And so those sorts of folks, you know, don't see any problem brokering these sorts of relationships with Russia. I mean, you know, I'm sure you talked about this with Jeff Charlotte, you know, the de facto head of the family, so the group that organizes the National Prayer Breakfast, Doug Burgley, he's been doing work in Russia for 40 years,
yeah.
and you know, spoke at an event, a prayer breakfast in Russia alongside Alexander Torshin, who was is widely believed, according to a lot of reports, to be very closely associated with Maria Butina, the woman who again tried to exploit the National Prayer Breakfast, allegedly to broker a back channel. And so, you know, these sort of connections for a lot of these players don't seem to rub people the wrong way. And I'd be really curious to see how this plays across the rest of evangelicalism. Because right now, I share in your perspective that I'm not hearing a lot of alarm bells in a lot of evangelical communities. And, you know, I'm sure that they would argue that there are no alarm bells to ring. But to answer your question, no, I don't see a lot of pushback.
Yeah. Jack Jenkins is the award-winning national religion reporter for Religion News Service, a non-sectarian, non-partisan, non-profit news organization covering the impact of religion and religions on contemporary life. Jack, we're going to be watching as to where this series of writings go. And listen, thank you, man, for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. I began today's show with a plea for your intense attention because of the onslaught of changes that are impacting our politics and dramatically altering our values. State of Belief was launched to keep people abreast of what's going on in religion, politics, and government with conversations characterized by civility and trustworthy information that listeners hear as motivation for citizens committed to the values of our Constitution and the democracy we enjoy but no longer can take for granted. What we've talked about on today's show is a clarion call for good citizenship and the voices and actions of all of you who want to work harder to assure a nation committed to equality and justice, the rule of law, and a land that cherishes freedom, especially real religious freedom as defined in the First Amendment. The news is troubling, but it is a pleasure to meet you each week for conversations that can help right the direction of our nation and preserve the vision that motivated our nation's founders. Now, if you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations that we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.